A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
William, Donald and Amy McSwan have gone to Scotland. Or Ireland. Or was it America? It was one or the other. I mean, does it really matter?
Johnny's ruse was simple. A shy, reclusive family, who were never reckless, impulsive, and rarely went out, had unexpectedly fled the country in the dead of night, leaving behind everything they had ever owned, from their homes, businesses, stocks and savings, to their teacups on the table, their bread in the basket, and their clothes in the cupboard. But somehow, it had worked. The McSwans were an intensely private, tightly knit, and deeply loyal family who kept to themselves. So with no close relatives or concerned family, no one reported them missing. Armed with a set of keys, a forged letter and a power of attorney, over the next few months, Johnny paid the remaining rent on their top floor flat, settled any bills, collected the post, tipped the milkman, topped up their gas meter with coins, and even paid Max's monthly subscription to the Amusement Caterers Association. On paper, the McSwans still existed, just not in person. But as clever and calculated as Johnny was, being so uncaring and eager to fritter away this family's fortune, he was also brazen and callous. And having let himself in, rifled through the drawers and flogged off the dour clothes and sparse furnishings of the recently deceased, Johnny sold everything. And before he sold all four of their houses, cocky in his confidence, he even collected the monthly rents, in person, having signed the rent book himself. As for the McSwans' pitiful pension of a piffling 22 shillings per week, he left that, as it wasn't worth his time. Within a few months, having stolen the equivalent of £210,000, Johnny had dissolved every single asset of the McSwan family, until just like their corpses, nothing existed. By August 1945, having made enough money to last a lifetime, the killing spree of John George Haig, one of Britain's most infamous serial killers, should have come to an end. But it didn't. Johnny Haig was jubilant. Yes, 1944 had been a right dog's dinner, but with 45 going great guns, 46 being a real pip, and although Britain was in the grip of post-war austerity, for Johnny, 1947 was looking to be a bit of a doozy. 1 month after he had casually flushed the whole McSwan family down the sewer, billowing with banknotes, Johnny permanently moved into the rather upmarket Onslow Court Hotel. Room 404 was his manpad. An exclusive serviced room with Indian linen sheets on the soft-sprung mattress, an armchair for entertaining his chums, a wardrobe full of his tailored suits, a drawer for his dress shirts, silk shorts, ties and hankies. So Johnny the entrepreneur always looked dapper. And at his desk, a fountain pen, a diary, several books on mechanics, and an Imperial typewriter. Catering to his every whim, the bellboy polished his shoes, the maid cleaned his room, the concierge collected his dry cleaning, and the night porter emptied his waste bin. So with nothing to do but to choose between breakfast, luncheon, tiffin, high tea, drinkies, din-dins, or a little late supper, he busied himself by mingling in the dining room with the wealthy, the cultured, the respected, and the widowed. That said, as much as South Kensington's most eligible bachelor loved to tootle about town in his dark green Armstrong Siddeley saloon, the bright glint of its waxed body, the subtle squeak of its leather seats, the luxurious whiff of a walnut dash, and the solid rumble of its 20-horsepower engine really turned some heads. Unfortunately, he felt it was a bit fuddy-duddy for a real go-getter, so his new wheels would have to go. But it wasn't all play, you know. Johnny's company, Union Group Engineering, was up and running. Established to give legitimacy to his purchase of high quantities of lethal acids, now as a legitimate businessman, he used his money to develop ideas with inventors. Okay, he lied a little bit. His business address was a hotel room. His title of technical liaison officer was self-appointed. The BSc initials after his name related to a phony degree. And he had no training as an engineer. But then again, half of success is confidence, right? In 1945, he invested in a needle threader. In 1946, he dabbled in toy rocking horses made from tubular steel. And in 1947, having invested £225 in Hursley Products Limited to develop a silent jackhammer and a battery-powered fan, the boss, Edward Jones, appointed Johnny as nominal director. Eager to make a go of it, Johnny didn't take a wage. But instead, he relished the role's credibility, the extra petrol rations, and keen to develop his own inventions, having purchased it off Alan Stevens, Edward gave Johnny access to a small storeroom in Crawley, based at number 2, Leopold Road. So had the sadistic serial killer stopped his killing spree to become a serial investor? Well, yes, he had. Ex-con Johnny was gone, as having realised his full potential and blossomed into a respected company director who lived well, dressed fine and spoke properly. Moving in middle-class circles, this gave him the perfect opportunity to meet like-minded people like Archibald and Rosalie Henderson.
I met the Hendersons by answering an advertisement for the sale of their property at 22 Ladbroke Square. They were staying at the Metropole Hotel in Brighton. I took Dr. Henderson to the storeroom at Leopold Road, disposed of him by shooting him in the head, and I put him in a tank of acid.
Simple. Of course, the Hendersons were not part of his original plan. Johnny wasn't a cold-blooded killer. He was a cool-headed businessman. But sometimes, try as you might, life has other ideas.
Sulfuring.
Johnny liked Archie. They were so similar. But whereas Mac was the little boy that Johnny once was, Archie was the older brother he aspired to be. Archibald Henderson was born in Glasgow on the 20th of July 1897, 11 years before Johnny. and although identical in many ways, Archie's upbringing was a blueprint to how Johnny wished his life had been. Raised in the prosperous Scottish suburb of Partick, to a housewife mother and a banker father, unlike Johnny, Archie was proper middle class. Not an uppity coal miner's son with lofty aspirations. As part-time Presbyterians, who embraced a faith when it suited them, Archie's early years weren't silent and stuffy like the Plymouth Brethren, but were bright and joyous affairs, full of music, colour, laughter and life. And as intensely social people, they were liked, trusted and welcomed. Educated at the affluent High School of Glasgow, just like Johnny, Archie was gifted a great education. But as a daydreamer who wasn't academically blessed, although he loved science and mechanics, he struggled. Conversely, whereas the undersized boy in the bow tie, with no siblings and friends, saw school as a very solitary experience, being tall, sporty, and a big personality, Archie loved school, had oodles of chums, and unlike this only child, he would never be lonely, as by his side was his big sister Ethel. Archie had everything that Johnny did not: money, style, class, and status. And as a strapping six-footer, with chiseled features, an athletic physique, and a very manly moustache, although unconventionally handsome, with sticky-out ears, pursed lips, and a stern stare that glared over the dark bags of his world-weary eyes, being a real man, Archie was someone that little Johnny Haig literally looked up to. But whereas Johnny was always patient, sober, and distant, as a deeply unhappy man with unfulfilled dreams of living a kept life to a wealthy wife, Archie was often angry, violent, and drunk. As a conscript, Private Henderson served in World War I. Unlike Johnny, he didn't dodge the draft. But being a lowly squaddy, with little respect for rank, routine, or regiment, he was never promoted. And yet, he held onto his medals, his gas mask, and his Enfield Mark I service revolver as souvenirs. Demobbed in 1919, 10 years and several tries later, he qualified as a doctor from Glasgow University. But being superior, stubborn, and self-important, with a dreadful bedside manner and a style which many doctors described as clumsy and inept, instead of patience, he preferred golf, gambling, and girls. Archie was unpredictable. Being crippled by spondylitis, a stiffness of the back, kyphosis, a curvature of the spine, and intermittent spasms in his left shoulder. As a debilitating and degenerative illness, his moody demeanour was made worse as he was forced to temper it with drink and prescription drugs. Just like Johnny, Archie hated hard work.
When I first discovered there were easier ways to make a living, I did not ask myself whether I was doing right or wrong. I merely said, this is what I wish to do. Go after women. Rich old women who like a bit of flattery. That's your market.
And although Johnny was yet to bag himself a biggie, Archie was way ahead of him. On the 18th of January 1930, 33-year-old Archie married 29-year-old Frances Dorothy Orr, a wealthy socialite with several lavish pads in Mayfair, Knightsbridge and Kensington, who spoiled him with shirts from Harrods, suits from Savile Row, and a bright red Lagonda sports car, as well as many expensive trinkets, including an 18-carat gold cigarette box and lighter, engraved with her name, Dorothy. Squandering his wife's wealth, Archie quit work to live a truly hedonistic life of drinking, gambling, and womanizing. As a heartless cheat who spent wildly, racked up debts, and shagged copiously, to Archie, She wasn't a wife. She was a meal ticket. As heavy drinkers, their South Kensington suite at No. 3 Grenville Place echoed to her volatile screams. As always cursing, fighting, and living in fear of his fists, Dorothy sunk into a deep depression. And for the last few months of their marriage, being drugged up and drunk, crying and catatonic, she lay there, bedbound and broken, cuddling Pat, her red setter puppy. Not that Archie really gave a rat's ass. As with his wife wasted on scotch and sleeping pills which he had prescribed, he openly flaunted his torrid affair with their friend and neighbour, Rosalie Ahrens. On the 20th of April 1937, simply to escape his abuse, Dorothy moved into a private suite at the Bailey Hotel at 140 Gloucester Road. 3 days later, she died. And although her family suspected foul play at the hands of Dr. Henderson, her money-grabbing husband, her death was declared natural causes, her body was cremated, and Archie inherited her entire estate. A total of £20,000, almost £800,000 today. Johnny liked, admired, and respected Archie. He was the older brother he never had, the only pal he ever wanted, and the affluent businessman he aspired to be. So it must have been a real bummer to have to bump off Archie. But hey-ho, that's the way it goes.
Sulfuric.
By August 1947, 2 years had passed since Johnny had slopped the hot mess of the McSwans down into the festering sewer. He was a new man now, respectable, honest, and successful, with a company to run, a full life to lead, and enough money to last a lifetime. Or so he thought. During the post-war austerity, although he'd invested in several inventions with Edward Jones, a silent jackhammer, a battery-powered fan, a needle threader, and he had dabbled in the mass production of a rocking horse made of tubular steel, nothing came of them. It was nobody's fault. It happens. But being shamefully shy on his rent at Onslow Court, forced to sell his dark green Armstrong Siddeley, which left just two cars in his rented garage, a sporty Alvis and a sedate Saloon 12, and with his good name sullied, owing £353 to five bookies, having placed a few bad bets at the Doggies and the Gigi's. So with every last penny shaken out of the McSwans, once again, Johnny was 1 month away from being broke. So, somebody had to die. He knew Edward Jones, of course. But why should he murder Edward? Yes, he liked him. And yes, he had some assets. A tidy house, a small engineering firm called Hursley Products, and a storeroom at No. 2 Leopold Road, which as co-director, Johnny, the enthusiastic but painfully unskilled inventor, would turn into a little workshop. But just like his old pal Alan Stevens, his income didn't amount to much. So setting aside their friendship, yes, he could kill Edward, but what would be the point? No, Johnny needed money. A lot of money. So he had to murder Archie. The day he met Dr. Archibald Henderson, having bungled the first three supposedly perfect murders, Johnny started making a mental checklist to ensure that the fourth would be just that. Perfect.
I found the Hendersons interesting and amusing. We went about a good deal together, and they liked me to play to them. I sat at their piano, interpreting the classics. The Hendersons talked a lot about themselves, and from many conversations, I learned a great deal about them.
On the 6th of October 1938, 1 year after his wife's abrupt death, Archie married his mistress, Rosalie Ahrens. Logistically, this was a tad inconvenient, as with the silly cow, legally now his next of kin, she had unwittingly volunteered herself to be Johnny's fifth victim. Which was a bit of a waste of his time, to be honest. But having done a double drum murder before, and as a nervous lady who was often drunk, drugged, and bedbound, in a style strangely similar to his first wife, should she die, the police would probably blame Archie. And with their closest relatives being his sister Ethel Norman in Jersey and her brother Arnold Berlin in Manchester, they couldn't affect the power of attorney. So legally, it would be a breeze. Asset-wise, Archie had frittered away his dead wife's estate. But as an impulsive investor who had recently sold his doctor's practice in Upminster, a 20-bedroomed guest house at 20 Ladbroke Square, and still owned a flat and a toy shop called the Dolls Hospital, all worth £600,000 today, they would, most definitely, be worth killing. Rosalie was a depressed neurotic with drink and drug issues, a history of secret affairs, wild spending sprees, and a suspicion of sadomasochistic sex. Archie was a crippled pill-popping alcoholic, with a violent temper, a succession of mistresses, and a string of bad debts. So although a very social couple, their impromptu vanishing wouldn't be unexpected, with it attributed either to suicide, stress, self-abuse, or starting a new life together, as they had discussed, in the South African city of Durban. Luring the Hendersons to their deaths would be a piece of cake. As a budding entrepreneur, eager to make a mint without lifting a finger, who was crippled by a bad back and wore a monocle to read, Archie's bait was obvious. And as for Rosalie, a bedbound, chronically depressed drunk, he had easily pried the reclusive McSwans out of their little hidey hole. So how hard could she be? His one major ball ache was that he never thought he'd be back here again, murdering for money. And besides, everything was gone. So, for the second time in 2.5 years, he would have to rebuild his murder basement from scratch. As co-director of Hursley Products, Edward Jones had given Johnny access to No. 2 Leopold Road. It wasn't much, but as a small, isolated storeroom, 30 yards from a remote side road in an industrial part of Crawley, with thick brick walls, no immediate neighbours, a messy yard chock full of indecipherable scrap, and hidden behind a 6-foot-high fence. Although it had no drain, it was private and perfect. Sadly, the 2 steel drums he had shipped to Allen's had been scrapped, as a caustic mix of rain and acid had caused them to irreparably rust. But having spied 2 in a nearby yard, he blagged both for just an ounce of tobacco and called in a freebie from his welder pal Thomas Davies to fix any holes and to fit both with a lid to limit the leakage of toxic gases. So actually, they were better than the old drums. With a black mark against his company's name, which slightly sullied his business terms with Canning & Co., he ordered a Winchester of hydrochloric and 3 10-gallon carboys of sulfuric from chemical wholesaler A. White & Sons, at the cheaper price of £4, 8 shillings and 7 pence. As for the rest, the previous occupier had left behind a stirrup pump, so instead of slopping out £535 of highly corrosive acid by bucket, Johnny could now safely fill up the drums without any risk to himself. Also being gifted a thick rubber apron and a pair of rubber gauntlets, from neck to knees and fingers to forearm, Johnny was now fully protected from any acrid splashes, and all at no extra cost. And as a frequent visitor to the Henderson's flat over their Dole's Hospital toy shop at 16 Dawes Road, Johnny swiped Archie's Army-issue respirator, so it was goodbye to the old gas mask made from cardboard and string, and saying farewell to the pinball table leg, the length of lead pipe, and the old rusty hand axe, he pilfered his Enfield Mark I service revolver and an envelope of 11 38 caliber bullets. So to be honest, starting from scratch was all pretty simple, actually. On Friday the 5th of February 1948, in the workshop of Thomas Davies, Johnny dangled a tasty morsel, a rocking horse made of tubular steel. As a toy shop owner, Archie loved it. Being short-sighted, he popped on his monocle to inspect it, and with his back aching, he winced as he bent over the bench. But with no sale made, Archie left empty-handed, Thomas was annoyed, but for Johnny, it was fine. On Saturday the 6th, with Rosalie unwell and eager to recuperate, the Hendersons packed three suitcases, all exquisitely marked with a monogrammed H, into their red Lagonda, and accompanied by Pat, they drove from their flat in Fulham to the more isolated Kingsgate Hotel in Broadstairs, Kent. Away from their social life, routine, and anyone who knew them. On Tuesday the 10th, with the Kingsgate being too quiet, they moved to the Metropole Hotel in Brighton, just 21 miles from Leopold Road. Having checked in for six nights, with Rosalie unwell, the housekeeper brought her a hot water bottle and a portable radiator. The maid delivered her meals to her bed and asked to walk her elderly dog. The night porter noticed a vast array of medicines on her bedside table. As in the evenings, the waiter served Archie and a small boyish man with a little moustache. As a busy hotel, which catered to their every whim, the staff noticed nothing suspicious. And why would they? On the morning of Thursday the 12th of February 1948, with Rosalie still very much bedbound, Archie left for a business meeting. No one was concerned, no one reported him missing, and he was never seen alive, ever again.
The Hendersons were staying at the Metropole Hotel in Brighton. I took Dr. Henderson to the storeroom at Leopold Road. I disposed of him by shooting him in the head with his own revolver, and I put him in a tank of acid.
But was it really that simple? Well, yes, it was. Convinced to leave behind his rather ostentatious red Lagonda sports car, as planned, Archie caught the train from Brighton. He was picked up at Crawley Station by an unidentified man in a slightly drab Saloon 12, and sedately driven to an industrial part of town, down a remote road, and into a secluded yard, hidden behind a six-foot-high fence and the closed double gates at No. 2 Leopold Road. Being mid-morning and mid-week, of the few neighbours whose premises surrounded the street, with their own busy lives to lead, neither the laundress, the metal presser, or the stable yard owner saw, heard, or smelled anything out of the ordinary from this engineer's workshop. As Johnny pulled in and parked up his car inside the private yard, his new pal Archie got out. It was an odd little place. Around the fences was a scruffy sea of tangled trash. Tires, boxes, and mechanical bits and bobs. And dead centre was a laughably tiny box-like storeroom, barely the size of Archie's bathroom, with one door, two windows, and a reassuring sign which read Hursley Products. It was just as Johnny had described. Small, simple, but suitable for an ambitious entrepreneur. So led in by his pal and potential business partner, although Archie's bad back made his walk slow and laborious, Johnny took his time. He was in no rush, as death comes to us all eventually. And to some, sooner than most. Unlocking the only door, with the only key, to the storeroom only Johnny had access to, Archie sensed no danger, no threat, and no suspicion. As in broad daylight, he entered the small brick-lined room of a keen inventor who dabbled in plastics. As expected, hung on a hook on the whitewashed walls was a thick rubber apron and two rubber gauntlets. Nearby were three carboys of unidentified liquid, two steel drums, and flush against the walls was a waist-high bench, on which something drew his attention. Popping his monocle to his dark-circled eye to inspect an invention his pal had placed before him, a six-foot Archie craned over the three-foot bench. He winced a little as a familiar sharp pain shot up his stiff spine, causing his movements to slow to a crawl. But again, Johnny was in no rush. This was all part of his superior plan. As with his victim being short-sighted and partially crippled, this gave Johnny ample time, as from behind, he took aim with Archie's own revolver. In a single shot, his head exploded, as at close range, the .38 caliber bullet ripped through his skull, brain, and face, as a fine mist of mucus and blood spattered down the whitewashed wall, causing his monocle to crack as his half-mangled head thumped against the bench. And the lifeless and almost faceless body of 50-year-old Archibald Henderson slumped in a heap on the dusty floor, dead. It was brazen to shoot a man in broad daylight between two windows. But Johnny was unfazed. With one down and one to go, pockets were emptied, limbs were hogtied, and the body was slid into the drum. But before the acid, the disposal, and the death of Rosalie, which is a mere formality, really was a huge waste of his time. Before all that, he had lunch. Johnny liked, admired, and respected Archie. He was the older brother he never had, the only pal he ever wanted, and the affluent businessman he aspired to be. And although it should have been a real bummer to bump off his buddy, actually, it wasn't all that bad. So with his body dissolved, his assets legally swiped, and the man himself having vanished completely, Johnny would literally become Archie. Everything would now be his, from his home, his bank, his bags and his business, to his shirts from Harrods, his suits from Savile Row, and his 18-carat gold cigarette box engraved with his dead wife's name. He took everything, even his blue silk dressing gown, exquisitely marked, as everything was, with a monogrammed H. Everything he liked, wanted, or was fond of was taken. Even Pat, his elderly red setter. And as Johnny drove the corpse's bright red Lagonda through the West End, although the open-top sports car ruffled his immaculately parted hair, the throaty roar of its 30-horsepower engine and the high-pitched squeal of its racing wheels announced to the city that Johnny Haig had arrived. In his diary, Johnny marked the occasion.
I wrote an A for Archie and the sign of the cross. He came to his end before midday.
Unlike the McSwans, his death had been a doddle. Everything had gone swimmingly. Archie was dead. Rosalie was next. His tools worked well. The storeroom was secure. The body was hidden. The assets would soon be legally his. And the scrambled eggs were smashing. So why should the rest of it be anything but simple? The murder of Rosalie Henderson should have been easy peasy. But something would go horribly wrong.
Sulfuring.
Friends, thank you so much for listening to Murder Mile. That was part 4 of Sulfuric, the true story of John George Hague, with the penultimate part of 6 continuing next week. A big thank you to my new Patreon supporters, who are Steph Thomas, Jim Hendry, and Paxoman. And as always, a special thank you to everyone who has liked, shared, commented, and reviewed this small independent podcast. Murder Mile was researched, written, and performed by myself, with the main musical themes written and performed by Eric Stein and John Books of Cult with No Name. Thank you for listening, and sleep well.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Okay, yeah. Oh, right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that was that. Cool. You're probably hearing, you'll listen to this and you're going, oh, that was good, I hope that was well. That's the second recording I did of that this morning. Oh dear. So, I'm moored up on the canal, as always, because I live on the canal and record on the canal. All good. I got a very nice neighbour to the left of me. He's a good bloke, very nice. Met him on the first day. He's got a bigger boat than mine. Much bigger, much higher, much longer, much taller. So, because I was on the nearest towpath, he was on the outside. I said, look, let's swap it around because your boat is bloody huge. And I can get on the outside, which is better. That's the way it should be on the canal. Big boats on the outside, little boats. Oh no, big boats on the inside, little boats on the outside. So we did the swap and that's all very good. But I needed to record. And because it can be quite noisy and, you know, dawn and coots, bloody coots. It's quite noisy. I decided this morning, let's get up at 5 a.m. because just outside my boat is the towpath. But the towpath, the slabs in it, they're not particularly good. They have a bit of a rocking sound to them. So every 3 minutes or less at this time of the morning, a bike goes past, it goes,
dun, and it's really loud, and you have to stop everything, and you know, there's the bin men doing their job, but also, I thought, let's get up early and get all that done. But also, my neighbour has a back boiler on his boat, so because the only way you can really make hot water on a boat is either you put your fire on, or you, like I do, you use your oven, or you have a back boiler. You switch it on early, and then when you wake up, you can have a shower. So I thought, right, let's get up at 5 a.m. That means I can start recording at like 5:15, start recording, get through it, and then by the time hopefully he wakes up around 7 a.m, which is the time is now, his back boiler, he'll just be switching it on. Therefore, if it comes on now, when Extra Mile's on, who cares? No one cares about this bit. But the first bit is important. Anyway, I woke up, got everything set up, and the second I sat down to start recording, and it's not loud, but it's just, it's kind of that drone in the background. And I thought, oh no, what do I do? So I've got all my bed sheets up on the windows and the doors and everywhere, and all the pillows up, and I've moved my desk around, so I'm not in my proper seat. I'm in a creaky seat. Probably hear it's creaking away, so every time I breathe it moves, so I've shifted my way around the other way. My little sound booth that I made it out of a shoebox and some sponges, that's there, and I can still hear it. And I thought, you know what, sod it, I'll keep going, I'll record this, but I'll record the sound of the back boiler, and then hopefully I can isolate that sound later on. And then 3/4 of the way through this record, I'd done it, it was going really well, and then it must have been about just after 6, he decided to switch off his back boiler, and I was like, oh no, it was off, and it really distracted me, because all of a sudden, now I could hear everything, I could hear myself, and I was like, oh, it was a good recording, but I thought, you know what, sod it, I'll redo the whole lot. So I redid that. So that's that. That was exciting, wasn't it? Probably not. So I hope this is recorded okay. I'm recording this now, and as soon as this finishes, unfortunately, now after that, I have to go back in and check that I clicked the right setting on my recording. If I haven't, that means I've got to redo it again, which I'm not looking forward to, because we're running out of time. We're not running out of time, but I'm trying to. I've got. What is this? Is this 2nd of December? 2nd of December today? I don't know. Anyway, I've got to try and get this done. Because the last episode goes out Christmas Eve. And what I don't want to be is racing to get the episode done on Christmas Day. I want Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, Boxing Day off. Dear Lord. Right. I'm going to make myself a tea. Yay. Anybody want one? No, good. Pop one on as well. Treat yourself. Oh, I haven't got any socks on. Really cold. My fire was still on when I woke up, which was nice. The coals are still warm, etc. So everything was nice, but now it's gone a little bit chilly underneath. Open the windows. Cup of tea. 2 sugars, obviously. Don't mind that. Powdered milk, yeah, even though it's winter and I can get milk, I try not to have too much milk and too much sugar. So there we go. Oh, coming back. Oh, I did consider almost doing this in my bedroom today. I did consider putting all the sheets up and popping a table on my bed, because I don't have a desk in there, but I have a movable table. I thought about putting it on my bed so I could stand up and record it there, but I thought, oh, sod it, let's just try this. And then he switched his bloody back boiler off. It's so loud. But you live on the waterway, you've got to put up with things. So, right. Where am I? It's start of December, going really cold. Fire's on, which is nice. It's all nice and toasty. Got loads of logs. Got all my coal. Got all my gas. Got all my water. Everything's good. I'm kind of heading out to a place where I'm kind of on a bit of a journey now. I'm heading near to a place where I'd normally moor up, so I can be near the archives. So at end of January, start of February, I can be near the archives. So when I'm there for like 4 or 5 weeks, I can just walk and cycle to and from the archives and be really close, rather than have to truck across town to get there, because it's down in Kew and it can be a bit of a pig to get there. Update. I think last week you probably heard me and I had a chest infection. It turned out it wasn't a winter cold of all things. Oh dear, burpees. It wasn't a winter cold after all that. What it was because I fractured 3 ribs a couple of years ago. Well, it was on my 40th birthday. Someone gave me some drinks. I fell into the canal. I either kneed myself in the chest or hit the water hard, or I hit the boat, but I don't remember hitting the boat. I didn't hurt my face. So, but what I know is I really, really messed up my ribs really badly. And because ribs are ribs, you can't, you know, unlike when you break an arm, you can't put it in a plaster. It basically is when it's broken and that's it. And they probably will repair themselves, but they'll never repair fully. But the problem is when you do fracture or crack or your ribs, because it's painful to sit up or roll over or anything or even breathe, you're not breathing fully. Apparently, so that means you're not expelling all of the toxins out of your system. So that's what I had. So a couple of weeks ago, oh dear, I was getting up in bed. I put my hands down by my side. I lifted myself up. I heard a kind of a crack, and I was like, oh, I felt like it was just my breastbone, but it was my ribs re-cracking. So that was it. That's what last week's was. It was a bit of a chest infection caused by that. So anyone who came on my tour end of November, don't worry, you wouldn't have got a cold from me. It was just a chest infection. How else are you doing? Diet-wise, this is interesting. Diet-wise, okay, I have had a couple of Bakewell tarts. I treated myself to some Bakewell tarts, some Sainsbury's ones. They do some nice Bakewell slices. Well done, Sainsbury's. They treated myself to some on Saturday because I'd done like a 20-mile cycle to go into town to record some of the videos, which go, I think one of the videos with this episode I recorded, 20-mile cycle to get in, did a tour, came back, did like 4 or 5 hours of editing, and then I thought, you know, I'd already walked 16,000 steps as well, so I thought, bollocks to it, I'm going to have some beers and some Bakewell tarts because I've earned it, so that was nice. But I had a couple of days when I was at the ACAS Christmas party, which was very nice, it was fine. I actually left at 10 o'clock. I was too tired. I couldn't be bothered with doing anything that night. I wasn't in the mood for partying. So that was all good. But then in the morning, I'd kind of prepped for a hangover, but I didn't really have a hangover. But I'd bought myself bacon and some bread, so I could do bacon sandwiches. I thought a good hangover cure. It didn't feel good. I'd bought myself treats, like a little bit of chocolate and some cake and stuff like that. And because I'd come off my diet, I felt really awful. I felt really sluggish and tired and had quite a few headaches. And it was weird. I think when you live on a diet, you might think to yourself, oh, my diet, you know, what I eat isn't that bad. But when you look at it, it is actually quite bad. We have a lot of, I don't normally eat a lot of processed foods, but it was weird. It was like, because I'm now used to eating like leeks and garlic and fresh fish and vegetables and fruit, and you know, I don't really have any wheat, but I have some rye bread and, you know, things like that, occasionally some eggs. I eat a quite a decent healthy diet, but when I came off that and had some processed foods, oh dear, I can really feel it in my system. It's like you put piece of chocolate on your tongue, and if you haven't had it for a couple of weeks, you can feel the fat burning into your tongue and you think, that's not right. And, you know, things in my stomach start feeling really weird. So it's, especially breads as well. Breads are kind of weird. Eating them and kind of, it's not just bloating you up. It's kind of, there's a weird. I felt really tired and sluggish and headachy. And I had some mayonnaise on a sandwich and I felt drunk. It's weird. All these things that we're kind of, I know your body can adjust to it, but whoa, weird. Didn't. Cup is almost done. Just wanted to say thank you to all the patrons out there. I know I always put a thank you to the patrons on the start of the show, but I put one in here as well because their funding has been really helpful to help fund this podcast. It's not laptops. Cup is doing. Hang on. Hold that thought. This is all academic, isn't it? Because I'm saying all these words, but if I've checked, I've got... If I've recorded this in the wrong setting, then I'm screwed, really. So this is all academic. Cup of tea. Lovely cup of tea. Nothing better than a nice cup of tea. Cup of tea. Oh.
Rich, if you're listening to this, I hope you're having a cup of tea with it. You probably are. Like me, you're probably having about 50 cups of tea a day. Minimum. You're probably not listening to this bit either, because you probably hate the sound of listening to me as much as I hate the sound of listening to me as well. Right. No, big thank you to all the patrons. Your subscriptions every week are very much appreciated. With that, what I've been able to do, I've covered the cost of my website for the next couple of years, which has been brilliant. The cost of having the domain there and the hosting is really expensive. It's like, and even though I know most people don't use it, it's really useful for the blogs and getting all the information out there. And, you know, it's an invaluable source. If you want to go and look at all the videos and all that, it's you know, I use, that's what the money goes for. I've also reserved the Murder Mile domain name for the next 5 years, which is great. But more importantly than that, I'm going to cover the years of my laptop on this. All of these shows have been recorded on my little laptop, my little Lenovo that I bought about three or four years ago now. Yeah, it was before I did the podcast. It was kind of the start of doing the tours. My little podcast. It was about 600-700 quid. It was the most I could afford. Doesn't have a massive memory, but it was enough. And I've used that literally for every episode you've heard so far, including this one. And I'll still be using this for the next couple of episodes. But what I've been able to do, because of the Patreon supporters, thank you very much, I've been able to buy a new laptop. So I've got a new laptop, an Asus. Asus is quite good. Good, fast one. Really good one for audio. It doesn't have all the graphics cards because I don't use graphics, but it's got good audio capability, larger memory, and even better, it has a huge battery on it. So this battery here on this one, it's meant to be about 6 hours. I think maximum I get is 4. Sometimes I get as little as 2.5 hours on it, which is not good when, because all this is recorded off battery power, because I don't have mains. Well, I do have mains, but if I switch on the mains, you'll hear a in the background, and that'll either be the engine or my generator, so I can't record in silence. So everything you hear and all of it being edited is mostly done on battery power, and it literally is. I have 3 hours maximum, and I'm racing to try and get things done and to write it as well, so it can be a real pain. But this new one has got a 14 hour battery. Now, even if part of that is BS, even if I don't get the full 14 hours, which I almost certainly won't, even if it's down to, even if you're half that, that's 8 hours, 8-9 hours. That's a whole day of work for me. So that's great. So that's saving energy as well, which is great. So I'm looking forward to that. So thank you to everyone. Thank you to the patrons on that. At the moment, I'm keeping money in there at the moment. What I'm trying to do is keep that as a kind of an emergency fund. So that's, the whole point is that, you know, I was predicting that this laptop will die. Of its USB ports, it has three. Two of them are gone. One of them, it's on its last legs. The mouse pad doesn't work. The keyboard doesn't work fully. It's like the screen, the touch sensitive screen, broke. It's really old, and it's the poor little thing. It's basically when I'm editing these shows, I have to keep hitting save like every 30 seconds or so, because if I don't, it crashes, and it, like, sometimes during an edit, like, it can crash like 2 or 3 times an hour. So just because it's like, it's about 10 gigabytes of data just for one episode, and my little laptop is struggling with that. So this will be my backup laptop from now on. So if anything goes wrong with the new one, I can just do that. Or I'm thinking about carrying this over to the archives. If the worst happens, worst comes to worst, I've still got my original laptop. So there we go. That was all uninteresting, wasn't it? Right. Coming up soon, what I've decided to do was, obviously this was episode 4 of Sulfuric. I hope you're enjoying it. It's, I said before, it's deliberately meant to be something very different from
Blackout Ripper and the Reg Christies, they had their own kind of style and thing. This is something very different in the way that I'm taking this entirely from the killer's perspective, which is something I rarely do. I'm very much not focusing too much on the victims. And also, it has its own style as well. So they're a real nightmare to create. Which is why in this extra mile sections, this is why I kind of say, I'm thinking about telling you this, but I might not. Because tomorrow I'm going to start working on episode 5, and I already have planned it. I've put all the data on my page, what I'm going to do. But I moved a lot of data from eps 1, 2, 3 to 4, and then 4 to 5. So there's things, like I said last week, there was things in episode 3 that I was going to use ep 4, but do you know what? I didn't fully use them here. Sometimes when you're writing it, you decide not to use them, or in the edit as well, you just edit them out for time. So what I'm thinking about doing, we've got a Q&A episode coming up that will be in the first week of January. That's basically the end of our season. So if you do have any questions, email me, use social media, or if you want to, you've got it on your phone, record me a little voicemail message, and then you can send it to me. My email address is on the website, mmiletours@gmail.com. It's easy to find. Or you can use a system called WeTransfer or any of those transfer things. Just send it to me, and then I can, instead of me reading out your email, I can, you know, can play your message. But keep it short. Keep it like 20 seconds. Otherwise, I'll have to cut it down. So we're doing that. But what I'm thinking about doing is doing maybe an extra mile, extra episode about John George Hague. Because there's loads of letters that I found in the archives between him. He wrote loads of letters, and loads of them are kind of the fake ones that he wrote from his dead victims, or letters that he wrote to his parents, or also, not mentioned in here, I'm probably not going to mention her at all, was his I mentioned her, I think, a little bit once, was his inverted commas girlfriend, Barbara. He did have an inverted commas girlfriend, Barbara, around the time of the murder. So I haven't put her in because it kind of throws you off a little bit. But I'm thinking about putting all of his letters to her and his parents in there, because I think they're really interesting and they give you an insight into his life. Right. Let me just see what we're going to add into here. Okay, so there were bits from last week that I didn't mention about, which was obviously he killed the McSwans. He had access to the house. He had the keys, so he could let himself in. The family were dead. He had power of attorney, so he could pretty much go in and out of the flat whenever he wanted. And the kind of the landlady and the neighbours who were there could hear him walking around 45 Claverton Street, which was the McSwans' family home, and they could hear him walking around and, you know, helping himself to stuff. But he legally he was allowed to do that. It was all on paper, so that was all fine. so I briefly mentioned that a little bit at the start of this episode, but the landlady was Mrs. Rathage. She lived in the basement. In there was also her daughter Constance and a tenant called Lucy Philippe. And he had told them that the McSwans had left for America. Although when I look in, I've mentioned this in this episode, when I looked in a lot of the other statements, he said Scotland and Ireland as well. It's like he changed his story a lot. Mrs. Rathage also received a call from Hague saying that they had to leave urgently. It was imperative, but the reason was unspecified. And she noted that Johnny Hague came back to 45 Claverton Street on several occasions to pay the McSwans rent. This was kind of his way of making sure that no one... Because obviously, this is the thing, isn't it? That people would kind of... would you notice that someone's missing? Yes, if they owed you money and the money was missing. But if the money turned up and they, you know... the money turned up and they were still missing, you wouldn't be that bothered. Which is why, you know, you hear those stories all the time about, like, people who die in their flats, and, like, a council worker comes in 3 years later and sees the mummified remains of a person, and the fire's still on and the letters have piled up. And everyone's like, why did no one notice? And it's like, well, because, you know, their rent was paid, their bills were paid. You know, today we've got direct debit, but in Haig's era, he was doing it himself. Do you know, he went in, he sorted out the milk bottles, he sorted out the post. Do you know, he made it look like he was officially there to look after their stuff. He paid the rent. He, as mentioned, he even paid Archie's Max subscription to the Amusement Caterers Association, which was a great way of, you know, it cost him a little bit of money, but it was he knew he'd get that back eventually through them by just keeping everything sweet. So that's kind of quite interesting. He asked for those. Yes, okay. So, Mrs. Lucy V. Philippe, who was one of the tenants there, Haig asked her to do some cleaning of the McSwan's flat, which is kind of a bit bold of him, given the fact that he was looting the place. And when she went in there, she was the one who said she found that it was full of, like, dirty teacups, and there was food in the cupboards and dirty dishes left on the table and bread in the bread bin. Everything was there. And they said this was really weird, as the McSwans, especially Donald McSwan, the father, was quite a tight-fisted man. There's a bit of a... They say... her quote in there is like being a Scotchman, i.e. another word for a Scottish man. He was quite mean and tight-fisted, but it's not to do with him being Scottish. It's his upbringing. Do you know, he was very conscious of keeping things away. And they said that he would never throw anything out. He would never waste anything. He was not a wasteful man. Do you know, like every piece of a loaf of bread would be used. You know, even if it was stale, he would find another way of using it. He was that type of person. So even though he had a load of money in the bank, he wasn't a wasteful man. So when they went in there, they found this was kind of interesting, that he would that things would be left behind. But Johnny Haig, even in the McSwan's own house, even though he got paperwork that says I'm dealing with their affairs, he sold a lot of their personal items to the landlady and the other tenants there, like their clothes and furniture and stuff like that. He was like, yep, he expired their rent. He said, okay, he paid for a couple of months, and then he said, okay, they don't need it anymore. So he got rid of the property. It was rental, so you could rent it out to someone else. And he basically, he had the other tenants kind of buy their stuff. So the crap that he didn't want, really. This was a quote. Mr. McSwan was a Scotchman, very mean. He would never leave things behind. That was Lucy's quote there. He'd said that they'd gone to very different places, either Scotland or Ireland or America. Interesting. Johnny Haig, he'd set up his own engineering firm. This was on paper. When he was murdering McSwan, he used the name Union Group Engineering. As mentioned, it was kind of because the name was nearer to Union Road and Tool Company, which was Alan Stevens' company. It's a very similar name, and they're both registered in Crawley. So I think he was trying to use it as kind of, you know, if anything goes wrong, Alan's company will be the one that they'll look at. But by late 1944, having murdered Mac McSwan, he really set up his own company, not just in name, but also as a real entity, with the aim of working as a kind of liaison between inventors, patentees, and engineering firms. As mentioned on his business card, he gave himself the initials of BSC, which is Bachelor of Science, and the title of Technical Liaison Officer that he'd used before. He said that he got the BSC from a correspondence course with the University of California, but in truth, this was bullshit. He also described himself as an engineer, but he had no technical training. His letterhead stated that he had branches in Crawley, Croydon, Putney, and Wimbledon, which was incorrect. And the company claims that they do general engineering, small repetition, which is large runs of identical parts, are gauge makers for MCS, which is measurement control systems. He also does, this took me ages to find out, IGA, which is instrument gauge analysis. Whether he did that, we don't know. This could have just been bullshit that he put on there. He was also based out of the Onslow Court Hotel, as mentioned. If you, as always, you know, I don't mention things unless they're important. for later on. I know some people listen to this podcast for like the first time and they go, why is he mentioning about all the things that a person has got in their room? What is the point in mentioning if they have flowers in their pot and things? But as you know, I only mention things if they're important. And so, but what I've done, as with all the other series, I kind of seed ideas. So obviously you've heard about Onslow Court multiple times before, in the same way you've already heard about Two Leopold Road, like four episodes back. Like, I lay all these things in, and even in this episode I'm laying things in for episode 5 and episode 6. So there's a lot in there. Had a look through, Johnny Haig did not submit any tax returns during this period. One of the things I did go looking for, I thought to myself, do you know, this would be interesting to see what actually his finances really are. I got access to his bank statements. They were in the police file. But there was no tax returns. He did not file his taxes. Naughty, naughty boy. What else have we got? We mentioned about the inventions he was working on. That was the needle threader, which was actually invented by Ernest Feuerherd. He'd met him around the time, just before or around the time that he was involved with Mac McSwan. Ernest actually died in 1948, so before the murder of Archibald Henderson. But even though he was dead, Johnny still kept touting this idea around of the needle threader and making money off it, even though he had no skills to do anything with it. He was also working on the pocket battery powered fan and the silent jackhammer, all of which came to nothing. Oh dear. Hursley Products, the company he hooked up with, he was appointed nominal director by managing director Edward Charles Rowland Jones. I just call him Edward Jones in this episode. They met in August 1945, being introduced by Alan Stevens, having done some experimental engineering at Johnny's request. Edward was originally based out of Leopold Road. It was one of the small premises he had, which he'd purchased off Alan Stevens. I had to put that in because it gets a little bit confusing that people always go, it was Edward Jones's property, but it wasn't originally. Originally, it was Alan Stevens' property, but then it became Edward Jones's property, which Johnny had access to. It makes it very confusing, so I had to layer that in early. So in 1945, when they met, Edward expanded in 1947. He had a premises of West Street in Crawley, and the St Giles, so the Giles Yard storeroom, which is at 10 Leopold, 10, 2 Leopold Road. Oh God, my brain's gone tired. £225 was the money that Johnny gave to Edward Jones for the company. For that, obviously, he didn't take a wage. He was really focused, as mentioned by this point, he was really focused on being an engineer and doing kind of important things of being an engineer, not being a killer. He'd got his money. He was like, right, killing's gone. Killing for him was literally just a way of getting money. That's all it. For him, it was like going to the bank. But you didn't take a wage with that. What he did was they worked together, and he would occasionally ask for favours, you know, like use of the storeroom, or do you know, as mentioned, ration coupons, petrol ration coupons. Obviously petrol was in short supply, but if you were a company director, you got extra rations because, you know, your job is more important than other people, and you know, you've probably got delivery trucks that need things delivery. So that's one of the things reasons why he did that. Jones's factory was at Brockworks at 15 West Street in Crawley, not too far away. What else do we need? Edward Jones and John George Haig got on really well. They really liked each other. There was, unlike with a lot of his victims, where he was kind of like he saw him just as saw his victim just as money. They had a kind of a mutual interest. They liked inventions together. They saw each other as investor and inventor. They had obviously the needle threader they were working on. They'd been advanced £400, which is a lot of money then, to develop the needle threader, and they were in discussions with Flextoll Engineering Company of Ealing to develop the silent jackhammer as well. So there was a lot of work going on. It hadn't really made them any money, but it was kind of, they had a mutual respect for each other. And also, Edward wasn't making major money, so he wasn't. There's no way that Johnny was going to kill him. Ay, 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 caramba. Yeah, they had originally met when Jones was doing a small detailed pieces for coil welding. I still haven't worked out what that is. I love diving into these things to find out what, like I did with the battery at the start, when it was like when they said the acid from the bell. And a lot of people in books, they refer to it as a bell, like a ringing bell, but it's not. It's a bell battery, the old acid bath type. I love doing that. I don't like things that don't make sense to me. I like diving in. What else we got? Oh yeah. Johnny was hemorrhaging a shit ton of money. I'm gonna have a slurp of tea. Around this point. Now, as mentioned, he was booked in Onslow Court Hotel, was just over £5 a week, which was a lot of money, plus 10% service charge. He'd got his 2 to 3 cars. He was renting out a garage. He also had another flat, which I haven't mentioned in here, but I've got a photo of it. I can post it online. At 38 Queen's Terrace. The problem is it's uncertain what he used that for. He also used various other hotels as well, but also not just his expensive life that he was living. He also obviously mentioned slightly he had a bit of a gambling problem as well. He really loved gambling. So he loved to back doggies and horses. Obviously, he went to the White City Stadium. Anyone who's works for the BBC, over the White City building is where the old White City Stadium is. It's where Freddie Mills did one of his most important boxing fights. I think, was that the one? That could have been the one where he became the light heavyweight British champion. But that doesn't exist anymore. It was a big, big, huge white palace of a building. That's now gone. Used to be a big... mostly a dog track, but apparently they used to do horse racing there as well. I'm not too sure. Not important to the story, but I know that he did a lot of his betting there. So, Johnny had a lot of debts. So to Wilson Fortescue of Burlington Street, he owed £115.16.6. That's since November 1946. They were commissions agents, which means they were bookies. And they said he would pay them off, but all the checks would constantly bounce. From R.J. Froom and Sons on Cambridge Street, he owed another £100 since November 1948. So that will be coming up soon. Oh, no, sorry, the account was September 1945. Again, he would try and pay them off, but the checks would bounce and he would send bullshit letters. Hendley and Coy of London on Regent Street, he owed them £54.19 since 1945. That was a betting shop. I might have a look to see where 87 Regent Street is, because it's on my patch. He keeps sending them letters on different letterhead, but obviously this would keep bouncing as well. He kept moving his money around and things like that. Cameron and Company on St Martin's Lane, this is back at Covent Garden, he owed them £45. Doesn't sound a lot now, but back then it really was a lot of money. Don't forget, he's paying £5 a week to live in a very expensive kind of serviced apartment in Kensington. So that shows how much £45 is. Again, he was sending letters saying, oh, yeah, here's your cheque. But they kept bouncing. Goodwin Brothers of Randolph Gardens, he owed £37. Again, same excuses. So in total, £353 in total. So that's a lot of money. How long are we doing for time? I'll just do a really quick bit. Archibald Henderson, so we mentioned all about that. That's good. I pretty much covered most of his back history, prominent background. Pretty much the same as Archie. This is what I'm enjoying, is the fact that you can see a correlation between him and his victims, which most people don't seem to have picked up on, which is weird. There is a direct correlation between him and his victims of what he wants and who he wants to be. And by writing this one, it's actually made me think a lot about the next multi-part series that I'm going to end with next year, which will take me a long time to do, long time to really research, because there's an angle I want to take on it. But by doing this episode, it's given me a little insight into something else. So Yeah, I'm going to have to make a note of that later on, of what I'm doing with this. Back to where I was. We got Archie, not a particularly nice man, a bit angry, an alcoholic. This is where they differ in many ways, is that although they were both kind of money obsessed, they hate working really hard, they were always looking for kind of a wealthy woman who would keep them as a kept man, both gamblers. But the difference was Archie was a massive drinker, and Johnny was not. Johnny would meet up with the Hendersons, and he would have a little sherry. He'd started to smoke a bit by this point, but that really was, he was never an excessive drinker at that point. He would have a sherry, and that would be his max. As mentioned, there is a wonder whether Archie did assist in the death. I'm being discreet how I put this. Assist in the death or decline of his first wife, Frances Dorothy Orr. Obviously, she had loads of properties around town. One at 39 Hanover Square, which is just off Oxford Street. Harrington Gardens in Knightsbridge. They got together because when Archie was at Glasgow University, one of his buddies was a guy called Dr. Henry McBride. And Henry and Archie studied together at university, and that's how he met Dorothy Orr, who was Henry McBride's sister. Why the names are different, I don't know. Oh, maybe she was probably married previously. I haven't looked into that. Unhappily married. They drank a lot. They quarrelled a lot. She went into a depression. There's a suspicion that because he supplied her with prescription medications and kept her drinks topped up, because when she was drunk, she'd pass out and stuff like that, that it led to her death. Nearing the end of her life, he had actually started working together. Archie had started working back again as a doctor. He was at Netley Military Hospital in Southampton. It was said that he didn't want the money. He just wanted to get away from her. So it was a very unhappy relationship. We'll be diving more into Rosalie, his wife, next week, which is why I've deliberately in this episode kind of bulldozed through her. Not literally, but kind of her life is kind of important to the story. So next week's is hers. What else we got? Oh yeah, this week. No. We'll save that for next week. I almost gave that away. No, I'm not going to say any more, only because I don't want to give away too much, because there's bits and pieces that will be important for next week, and I'm yet to write episode 5, so I don't want to balls it up. So that was that. What time is it? It's probably like 7:30. Oh, people are just waking up now, and I've done 2 hours. I'll do an edit on this, and then I need to start working on episode 5. Oh, what's going on outside? Coot was a little bit noisy this morning, but not too bad. He was kind of, it was only near the end, he was having a bit of a moment. I think someone had spilt his cornflakes or something pointless. And he was having a bit of a, but then he shut up for a bit, which was good. And normally there's a dog where I am, there's a dog that's outside that their owner, I don't know why, it's like every morning at 6 a.m. their owner lets the dog out. There's no gardens around here, so it must be a public garden. He lets his dog off, and his dog just stands there and goes, bah, 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 really loud, and just lets it bark for hours, and it's like, you little bastard. And there's a guy who goes past our boats every night at 11 o'clock singing, and he's got a really awful singing voice. Anyway, that's that. That was good. So I'm going to start editing this. Hope you enjoyed that. That was good. We've got 2 more episodes of Sulfuric to Calm, and then we've got I'll do the omnibus edition, so it's I'll put them all on 2 episodes, so you can listen to them back to back without the extra mile bullshit. There'll be a Q&A episode, and I will probably, I'm thinking about it, doing the as mentioned, the extra John George Hague bit with all the letters, because the letters are really interesting. There's a lot going on there. There's a lot going on that we can't. I could do you an extra episode of Sulfuric, but I'd said at the start it's a 6, and I feel it suits being a 6. I think an extra episode would be, an extra Murder Marlex episode will be a bit of an indulgence. We'd be covering a lot of the same ground. So I think it'd be better if it's an extra mile episode. So you can take the choice, decision whether you want to listen to it or not. Just like this waffle. Right, that's me done. I'm going to go and edit this. Not edit this. That makes it sound like it's really quick and I can do it in a day, which it doesn't. These take about 3 whole days to edit. And the last episode, I was racing against the wire because I was trying to get it out ready for the... Because Patreon listeners get this on a Monday. And I'd recorded it... When did I record it? I recorded it last Sunday. Before the tour that I did. But... Because I was working on writing this episode, and that was I didn't want to break my thread. I had to edit in the evenings. So I only got it finished on Sunday night, ready for the month. Oh, God, it was hard work. Anyway, 2 more to go. Right, shut up, Michael, shut up. Let's do stuff. Right, everyone, have yourselves a good day. Enjoy yourselves, have a cup of tea, have a cake if you want to. I'm going to have a Belgian bun. Lots of love. Catch you soon. Bye-bye.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.